From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The questions that occupied Alan Turing were the biggest ones imaginable. Could a machine make its own decisions? Could it come up with its own ideas? Could we give it something approaching a mind? And just what is a mind anyway? Turing was a great British mathematician who pioneered the science of computers. Many of us have come to know about him through the film The Imitation Game, which tells the story of Turing's role in breaking the Nazi Enigma ciphers during World War II. The book that inspired that film is a classic biography, and today in the program, the man who wrote it is our guest. Andrew Hodges tells the story of Turing, his brilliant, groundbreaking ideas, and the tragedy of his personal life, being arrested and humiliated for living his life honestly as a gay man. The story of Alan Turing today, after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jim Holt of The New Yorker magazine said Andrew Hodges' book on Alan Turing is one of the finest scientific biographies ever written. Turing is the British mathematician whose ideas were the groundwork for the modern computer. Many of you know his story from the new film, The Imitation Game, which has received a number of Academy Award nominations. Hodges' biography is exhaustive, nearly 700 pages, and the part you saw in the movie is just a fraction of the story. The film focuses on Turing's role in cracking the Nazi Enigma codes in World War II, which saved thousands of lives. It also tells the tragic part of the story, how Turing was arrested and forced to undergo hormone treatments for living his life openly as a gay man. He killed himself in 1954. Today in the program, Andrew Hodges is joining us to talk about Turing's life and his ideas. He teaches mathematics at the University of Oxford in Great Britain. He joined us from the studios of the BBC. Hodges said he first discovered Turing when he was studying mathematics in the 1960s. At first, he only knew about his role as a scientist.
Very few people knew anything about him personally in the circumstances of 1969, 1970. He was known as a very important person in computer science. And so there were little books about computers tended to have a little segment about him, not probably very accurate, but something. And his name, for instance, appeared in the Turing Award, which was the main award of the Association for Computing Machinery. It was the equivalent of the Nobel Prize for computer science. So you can't say he was unknown, but known in a specialist way. No one really knew much about his life. And no one knew either about his work in the Second World War. So those two things were both hidden.
At what point, I guess it was the merging of the science and the personal that got you interested in wanting to write about his life?
Well, it was quite specific for me. I knew his name in the way we've just described as a person who was a leading figure in the foundation of computer science. And therefore, it meant a lot to me when I heard from friends of his in the early 70s about what had happened to him as a gay man in the early 1950s in the events leading up to his death. So that meant a lot to me, but I didn't, I sort of felt I would like to know more about that and should know more about it, but I didn't actually do anything about it until the mid-1970s when it also hit me from quite a different direction that he'd been the most important scientific figure in the code-breaking operation of the Second World War. And at that point, I thought, there is much more to this death, for a start, than I'd realized, because he wasn't just any gay man caught up in the crackdown period of the early 1950s. He was this person who'd been the top guy in the most secret operation of the Second World War. Mm. And this is a really extraordinary story. And I was able to combine that with the purely academic, scientific, philosophical background, which I could also get myself into. So that was my ambition, was to bring all of these things together into one narrative.
I read the new foreword, I suppose, to the book by the American scientist Douglas Hofstadter. who said that it takes someone who shares things with Turing to be able to plumb his life story so deeply, as he said, enough to do it justice. And he says, you, being an accomplished mathematical physicist, you have that. I mean, do you agree that sharing science and math helped you really get it, Alan Turing?
Oh, I'm not sure I'm the best possible person to have done that, but I had a jolly good go. And it actually, in some ways, helped coming to his area of mathematical logic from outside that, because the logic people tend to see him as a logician and don't see the whole range of things he did outside. Mm. He wasn't really a typical logician at all. He was really more like a general purpose scientist who applied himself in all sorts of unusual ways, of which bringing logic to life in computers was just one. So it was actually quite good that I came from outside the absolutely standard scientific background to do that. Well, anyway, what Doug Hofstadter said was very nice, so I really appreciate him. He actually was rather similar, I think. He came to write his book, Gödel, Escher, Bach, which came out in 1979. Also, he came as an outsider to it, so I think he felt I'd done something slightly similar.
It's interesting to see how people are reacting to Alan Turing's life today. I mean, many are coming to know the story, of course, through the film. How do you compare that to how people took it in 1983 when you first wrote it?
Yes, well, that's a good point. I mean, it did make quite a mark when it came out in 1983, and an example of that was that it was taken up as a stage play by the dramatist Hugh Whitemore, who made a play called Breaking the Code, which played in London's West End and on Broadway for about 6 months. And that really took essentially the moral political drama of the story very seriously and made quite an impact. It was a television play as well. So one can't say that it was ignored or didn't have a public impact. And Derek Jacobi, actually a very well-known actor, took the part then. Now, what's the difference now? I think something happened. I'm speaking more from a British perspective here, I suppose, but I think there's something a bit more general than that. We had a real change in about 2000 in the sense that sexual orientation became seen as a human rights and equality issue along with everything else. Right. It wasn't seen as something rather on the side and rather dodgy anymore. It really became much more central and embedded in how institutions should work generally, not as a sort of special pleading thing, but just central to what was going on. And we've really experienced that in the university sector where I work. That it really has made a big difference. And that means that the story, as it came out and was seen in the period after 2000, had a different resonance. It became not an individual tragedy story, which was more how it was seen in the 1980s, but as a central human rights story, and indeed a central second 20th century history story, and something in the middle of things and affecting the whole narrative of the modern world. People seem to have taken it much more to their heart somehow. I can't know exactly why, but there does seem to have been a change like that.
You do mention in the new preface that you've written to your book that Turing himself anticipated there would be a social revolution that would come, but I guess it's a pretty poignant that I guess it was too painful to wait for it, but he did see it coming, I guess.
Well, he was ahead of his time. Yeah. I mean, there was an interesting time in the early 1950s. It was precisely because there was an increased persecution and crackdown, itself pushed by the concept of national security of the McCarthy period of the 1950 onwards. It's because it became a more public issue that there was resistance and it was controversy. It was a public issue for the first time, what was supposed to be done about homosexuality. In Britain, it led to the setting up of a royal commission, which advocated changing the law, which was indeed mostly changed in 1967 and then really finished off in about 2000. And then parallel things have happened in the United States. So that was an interesting period, and that was a period in which Alan Turing had a full part. I mean, he was very much part of that story. And his reaction to what happened was one of resistance, and it was one of thinking the law was ridiculous, and also of trying to get out of the situation by going to other countries, and in particular going to Scandinavia in 1952, an interesting thing, because that's where one of the first European gay rights movements started, and he certainly must have got caught wind of that.
You mentioned that I wanted to get you on this, because this seems a very important point. You say in the book early on that though Alan Turing, you know, played this central part in world history, that it would be misleading to portray his story as a power player, one that was political in some ways, because you say he wasn't terribly political, or at least that's what I gathered from what you had written. Explain what you mean.
Yes. I mean, I think that's it's a difficult word to use, but there was a very definite sense of being a political person in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, which mostly revolved around the question of alignment with the Communist Party. I mean, that's what, on the whole, being a political person would have meant to the Cambridge intellectuals of that period, right through from the period before the Second World War to what happened afterwards. That was the sort of central point. And, well, Alan Turing wasn't caught up in that question. I mean, that wasn't his thing. In 1933, he flirted with what was the Communist Front organization, the anti-war movement of 1933, but he really wasn't part of it. He certainly knew lots of other people who were part of the left wing of that period, but that wasn't his thing.
He was more of a Keynesian, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so one of the people I do compare him with, who's actually quite a close person to compare him with, is Maynard Keynes, who indeed he would have known, and indeed probably helped him get into the secret work in 1938. Keynes was a senior fellow at King's College, Cambridge, where Turing was a junior fellow. And they had a lot of certain similarities anyway, and certainly similar moral perspective. But Keynes was definitely a liberal, rather than a socialist or communist.
What really seems to have mattered to him, and this gets to, I think, even the larger point, was that what mattered to him was, as you write, the individual freedom of mind. And that included his sexuality. It included the way he thought about science. I mean, that was crucial to him.
Yes, that's the way I draw all these things together. I mean, to some extent, that's me trying to make an answer to the kind of question you're answering. And that's the way I put it, that he was very much against anything he'd call phony or what we call now bullshit. He wouldn't have liked anything about the communist line because it meant having to put up a certain front and follow a line and say all sorts of things you probably didn't really believe in for the sake of the cause. That was absolutely not him at all. I mean, Turing certainly was on the left liberal side of things. He wasn't on the conservative side. And he was definitely on the anti-fascist side and was very aware of the threat of Nazi Germany in the 1930s. But he stuck to this essentially liberal position, and where his own freedom and own integrity and own honesty came first. One of the ironies is that he was drawn into the secret work where he could, doing all sorts of things he could never talk about.
Right, right.
That's a great, great, great irony.
There's a central theme in the book I wanted to ask you about. It's this idea of linking logical possibilities with physical reality. I mean, this is very important. In fact, this is kind of how you've organized the book.
It is indeed. I'm very glad you've drawn attention to that. And that's one reason I said I didn't come to it as someone within the sphere of mathematical logic, for whom logic is everything. He was not. It was logic applied to science. And he did something, had no name at the time. It has a name now. It's called computer science. Yeah. But he didn't have that name then, because he created that link between what we'd now say was software and hardware. It's between the idea of a program and then actually being able to run that on an actual physical computer. But that he was unusual as a mathematician. On the whole, mathematicians do keep to doing mathematics on paper. Right. He had a great yearning to do things which went outside that world, jumped out of the box. He wasn't at all a typical Cambridge mathematician like that. And he wasn't particularly good at the practical or engineering things, but he had a great yen for them. And that really did shape the whole of his career. And in particular, it really just had this tremendous payoff in the way he could apply that combination of logical ideas, but actually getting something to work in a physical way in the code-breaking work.
I mean, I'm trying to think of the things in my own life that I use every day and probably take for granted that came from Turing's mixture of, you know, the physical with the logical. The search engines are one, for example. They have these algorithms that you describe as really the descendants of Turing's ideas.
Well, I mentioned search engines because they are, for two reasons. I think they give you an example of a very powerful algorithm, which is so powerful you can hardly believe it's really doing it in the time that, he seems to come back with an answer even before you finish typing. I mean, right. But it is just following through a sequence of instructions. And that is an example of what Turing conceived as what's always called a Turing machine. Yeah. But the other reason is that his code-breaking the machine, the bomb, which worked on the Enigma, was like a search machine. I mean, that's one way of picturing what it did. So it has a particular closeness to something he was very interested in.
Andrew Hodges, he's the author of Alan Turing, The Enigma. It's the inspiration for the film The Imitation Game, which just received 8 Academy Award nominations. The film is screening at the Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake City and in theaters around the valley. You can go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org, for details on the book and the film. We're going to take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the brilliant mathematician and computer pioneer Alan Matheson Turing. Some of you have come to know Turing's story through the film The Imitation Game. Our guest today wrote the book that inspired the film. Andrew Hodges is a mathematician himself at Oxford, and his book explores Turing's role in cracking the Nazi Enigma code during World War II, but it's also about the life he lived as a gay man. Hodges says Turing was born into an English class system that determined much of a person's life.
Well, they were lower upper middle class.
Right.
I mean, there is a very, I don't know. It's all a completely vanished world now. Yeah. It's fascinating in all the literature and memoirs of that time. You could cut all these class distinctions with a knife, you see. If you read E.M. Forster or George Orwell or these people of that period, you learn all this stuff. But it certainly was very rigidly determined by his father being a officer in the Indian Civil Service. In the last days of the British Empire, really. And everything revolved around that. And the whole structure of education and career actually was determined by that structure in a way that hopefully no one is quite so programmed now. So you need a bit of that to see why on earth they went through all these things that they had to do. But he, of course, ignored it as much as you possibly could, really. But as we're talking about being political, not in the way of other people of that period, by being a great rebellion and saying, this is, you know, I object to this. You see, he always found this sort of way of moving sideways so as to avoid direct confrontation, but just do his own thing in some other way. Mm. That was more his style.
I liked this little factoid in the book that the Turing name wasn't known early on for science or academia. His uncle had gotten a little bit of attention for books he had been writing on fly fishing.
Oh, yes. There are other distinguished Turings in the world, actually, yes. But he wasn't well known as a scientific family, although, yeah. In fact, he had a remote second cousin who was George Johnston Stoney, who is actually known for actually having identified the fundamental constants of nature in the late 19th century.
Yeah. Did he take to science right away? I mean, there was a book that you mentioned that was given to him when he was young that was had a really powerful influence on him.
Yes, he certainly did. I mean, there's no question that he and it wasn't just the scientific things or facts. He had an attraction to principle and the whole scientific worldview. It's a bit hard to... Well, I can actually quote his own words there, because when he was about 12, I think, he wrote in a letter to his mother, I seem to be... I can't remember the exact words because I'm speaking off the top of my head. Sure. But I'm drawn to all that is commonest in nature and to doing things with the least waste of energy. Now, that's quite remarkable because it's an abstract view. I mean, he's only 12 or so, but he's talking about his own take on science and describing it, as it were, from the outside and seeing it as a matter of principle, that he's pulling out certain principles that he'd like to see. And that was indeed typical of what he did in later life. He wasn't one for a great detail and getting absolutely everything right, and he wasn't one for following through the year after year after year of a project. He was much more keen on getting something started off with a big new idea, and then after that maybe other people could get on with it more. I mean, that's really what he did with the computer. So he diagnosed this at a very early age, and it was science, I think, rather than mathematics at that stage. A concentration on mathematics came a little bit later, I think, because he studied Einstein's own exposition, semi-popular exposition of relativity when he was about 15, 16. And that, I think, really did turn him on to the power of mathematics.
Did he, you describe him as being, at this certain phase, this early phase of his life, I'm not sure if isolated is the proper word, but he was maybe drawn inward at least a little bit. Because when we get to this crucial character, this boy, Christopher Morcom, he seems to draw him out of that. Can we talk about that part of
his life? Well, I think that's exactly right. Yeah. It is not surprising that he was out of it, because the whole environment was pretty hostile. I mean, it's difficult to imagine now the conventionality and fairly brutal discipline of the type of schooling that he had. And it wasn't one where his sort of free-ranging way of thinking had any encouragement at all. I mean, it was absolutely, you have to do this and you have to do that, and that's what everyone does and so on, which he largely ignored as much as possible. But you're absolutely right. I mean, there was this other lad who was very clever, but also fitted in. I mean, he showed how to do it and get on in life a bit more. And Alan Turing certainly, well, he was very attracted to this other boy. I mean, it must have been at this same stage when he was 17 that he would have been really aware of his homosexual nature coming out. I mean, I can't say at what point he would have put that word to it, but given that there was, you know, all at school like that, they were always talking about crushes and attractions and so on. It was common currency. He must have been extremely aware of it. And the thing is, it wasn't just that. It really was an attraction to a world of science as well.
Right.
And in fact, well, the Christopher Morcom, he did come from a scientific family, or a scientific and engineering family. That was quite different. And Turing was very attracted to that whole background, as well as to the boy himself. So that played a big part in focusing himself. And indeed, that's what happened, though not in the most obvious way, because, as you'll know from the story, Christopher suddenly died.
Yeah.
And that meant that Alan had to... Well, he was being left very, very much alone. It would have been, I mean, looking at it really, I mean, for any young person to go through that self-discovery as gay in a very hostile environment without any kind of support, and also to have suffered bereavement, is really a pretty devastating thing. And how on earth he came through that in that environment is really hard to see. But he did have this great, well, he did have great strength.
He did. Well, he was 18, of course, when Christopher dies. And what I found so interesting about that part of the story is the, I mean, the letters and the essay that he writes to Christopher's mother, where he basically, at least as I see it, kind of, he basically processes his loss through this scientific theory, one that gets at free will and physical law.
I must say that was the most, probably the most amazing discovery I made in the biographical research, as when I had that from the through the kindness of the Morecambe family who'd preserved it, because it makes an amazing link between the individual and emotional trauma of 1930 and the whole direction of his intellectual life, which flowered in the mid-1930s, and explains why, well, I mean, explains, but I mean, casts a great light on why his interest in the nature of the mind was what was really coming out, and what that's what underlies his interest in the concept of computation. That's the whole basis of his theory in 1936, which underlies the computer, underlies his continuing great interest in the question of artificial intelligence. Yeah, it's a very remarkable thing that he turns it into this scientific essay. It has also, it's just a great interest because it shows the influence of the new physics on his thinking. That's something he would have talked about a bit with Christopher Morecambe, because it was in the very influential book by Arthur Eddington, The Nature of the Physical World, which was the first thing that brought to the general public the idea that quantum physics means we've got to completely change our idea about what space and time and matter are all about. And Eddington was very keen on this and conveyed that very forcefully.
So what Alan Turing was working out in his mind at that time then, and in those essays and these letters that he's writing to Christopher's family, is that the human mind, the question is whether the human mind, did it exist in some way outside of the body, outside of matter? And since the body of Christopher was now gone, of course, what had happened to this remarkable mind that he loved?
Well, he does say exactly that. And you can see how the emotional trauma is very, very intense. Alan was someone who had to get it as a scientific formula. In other words, he couldn't just believe anything he liked. He couldn't just believe anything it would be nice to believe. He had to think it through and see that it was scientifically valid in some way. My guess is that by 1934, 35, 36, certainly, he probably would have put aside those adolescent thoughts and had a much more mainstream scientific view, rather than casting around with ideas about survival of the mind after death and so on. I mean, I don't know, but I think that must be the case.
Well, it was at King's College in Cambridge where he begins to, as you say, transition away from that more emotional to the more intellectual. And it sort of, you know, as you say in the book, it's interesting, he seemed to be headed for the life of a scholar, one of those, you know, sort of mildly eccentric Cambridge dons, as you say.
Yes, but, absolutely right.
But
yes.
But his uniqueness of mind, you say, sent him off in a direction that really no one would have
I think is absolutely right. And then I think one can link that with the fact that the motivation for his work wasn't just getting ahead in the mathematical career, and it wasn't just fascination with pure mathematics. It had this very strong philosophical and indeed emotional base to it, which is a real concern for the nature of reality, in particular the nature of the way that mind is embodied in matter. So that took him in a direction which jumps out of the mathematical box. It used a mathematical problem and a deep problem in mathematics, but his solution to it wasn't within mathematics. In fact, that is actually the whole point of what he did in 1936, because the purely mathematical problem had been solved by the American logician Alonzo Church with a formalism which wasn't basically, it was entirely within this world of mathematical symbols. But what Turing did was found in a whole interpretation of this, which was outside mathematics, is to do with the world in which people actually do things. And that meant he could give a meaning to the word computation, or what it is to do something, It's a physical picture, and then it turns into something which can actually become engineering, and it is indeed the computer of today. So it's only by being partly outside mathematics that he could give this thing which founded a whole new area of science, is computer science.
So his idea basically was, if I understand it right, he has this idea about algorithms, basically about computer program, but this was before there was a computer to process something like a computer program, so he has to go out and invent that in order to process it. Is that
absolutely right? Yeah. Oh, that's the way I put it myself, to make it clear how crazy it all was. He had to answer the question. I won't go into the whole background of mathematical philosophy, but he had to answer the question, what does it mean to have a method for solving a problem? Yeah. What is a method? I mean, it's just a word, you see. I mean, you could give various other words like rule or algorithm. They're in mathematical literature. They're words that are used, but no one had given a precise definition. Well, he gave a precise definition, and it was through the concept of the machine, which very soon was called Turing machine. And now you can't describe that without saying, I mean, it's impossible to get away from the idea of a computer program now. Right. And we say that his definition was equivalent to saying, what I mean by a method is anything that can be done by a computer program. But the craziness is, there weren't any computers there. So this concept didn't exist. Well, the thing is, the craziness is resolved by the fact that Turing invented the idea of the computer, what he called the universal machine, in order to give meaning to his definition of what a rule or method was. And that's the definition which has not only lasted as a mathematical and philosophical definition, but given rise to the actual practical development of electronic computers, which do hold multiplicity of things.
Andrew Hodges, he's a mathematician, a writer, a gay rights activist. He's also a senior research fellow and tutor in mathematics at Oxford University. His book is Alan Turing, The Enigma. He joined us from the studios of the BBC in Oxford. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer and mathematician Andrew Hodges. We're talking about his biography of Alan Turing. Most people know Turing for his work in breaking the Enigma ciphers that the German military had developed. The work to break those codes was a complicated process, Hodges says, and he says the British team, including Alan Turing, were building off the work of others.
The Polish mathematicians who were employed by the Polish government had made great breakthrough into the Enigma in the 1930s. And they were deciphering a certain type of Enigma message in 1938 and knew a lot about it, and it got a long way, really. And they were miles ahead in the use of mathematical techniques. In July 1939, they gave that to the Brits and the French as well. And Alan Turing was involved by that time. He'd been involved since the summer of 1938. And basically, they ran with it and were able to push that much further, both with ideas and with actual machinery, than was available to the Polish people. That meant that Turing and Gordon Welchman, who was another mathematician, designed a machine which could embody a mechanical solution to Enigma messages, provided that you could guess quite a long stretch of the message, about over 20 letters. That's asking quite a lot, but you could do that as long as you've built up plenty of you've broken into messages in some other ways first, then you get a real feel for what's going on in the messages, and you can actually do this guessing game very successfully. So that was going very well on German Air Force messages from the later part of 1940 onwards. But the naval messages were much more complicated. They were guarded by, well, it's the equivalent of an extra password system. It's just a bit like having to crack a password system on top of all the rest of the Enigma. And that was much more difficult, and continued to be much more difficult throughout the war. But it was also the most important, because the naval war is absolutely a war of information. Right. It's all the difference in the world between a U-boat where you know exactly where it's heading to and what its orders are, and one where you don't know where it is and you don't know what its orders are. It absolutely depends on these radio messages which were going to and forth. There wasn't any other form of communication. So that was absolutely vital. But it was the most difficult, the most vital. Turing was able to work out what this extra password system was pretty early, actually, in the winter of 1939-1940, but he couldn't make any progress with it until the British Navy had made a capture of the paperwork, of the code book, which had this password system in it. And that wasn't achieved until February of 1941. They were very frustrated until that time. But once they got going with that, they were able to break all the naval messages increasingly throughout 1941. And if we're concentrating on him, that was his personal triumph more than anything else, I think. That would have been extremely satisfying in the spring of 1941 when they could break into these super enciphered messages and make a big impact on the really crucial control of the Atlantic Ocean.
You write about how what Alan Turing really seemed to care about wasn't the algorithms as much as it was the idea of intelligent machinery, what's come to be known as artificial intelligence. You say in the book that for Turing, artificial intelligence contained what you call the really fundamental scientific question.
That's right. Well, you see, as I've emphasized, you see, he came to the whole business of what is a computer all about through thinking about the nature of mind. And that's what his main interest was. And the way he described his ideas about computation was by following through the idea of what a human being is doing with their mind when they're doing a computation. So that was his underlying thing. And as we've discussed, it goes back to the Christopher Morcombe thoughts and so on. And that continued. That was to him the most primary scientific question, is whether studying computation could shed light on the human mind. And that was going well within the Second World War. I mean, it was very exciting, obviously, that the details of the algorithms that they used meant they were jumping ahead of what you could do with human guessing. I mean, that's essentially what they were doing. They were doing better than intuition or just guesswork could do by by scientific means, which nowadays would be incorporated in a computer program, but then they hadn't got computers, so they were doing it in other ways. But still, he could see that was what was going on. Mechanical methods were encroaching on what traditionally had been thought of as purely human capacities. And that was the thing which interested him most about the advent and development of computers. And when he set to work in 1944 for an actual electronic design of a computer in the modern sense, embodying his idea of a universal machine and motivated by all the algorithms which they'd been using up to that point, he called it building a brain.
Yeah.
I mean, just in a joke way, but there was a serious part to it. As a matter of fact, he met Claude Shannon, who was the founder of information and communication theory and pretty well a sort of opposite number in the world of science and in the Anglo-American relationship. And they talked about this very question in early 1943, so it went very early. It's quite surprising that in computer history, interest in artificial intelligence is there at the beginning. Right. It's not something that just develops later on.
He publishes this paper in 1950 about artificial intelligence that you say in the book shows a remarkable awareness of human life. And the paper is funny and packed with these cultural references and doesn't seem like an automaton wrote it. Someone who's full of life wrote it.
Well, I couldn't agree more about that. And that's one of the reasons, one of the most popular and most cited papers in philosophical literature. If you look at it compared with other papers in the philosophy of mind, of course, it just jumps off the page in comparison. It's full of jokes. One of his ideas, really, is that you couldn't call a machine intelligence unless he could understand a joke. And there are various mildly dirty jokes in the paper. And I mean, the criterion for judging intelligence is all around. It has to do with experience of life and the understanding of language. He's trying to get away from the idea that a computer would be doing be doing arithmetic very well, or it might even be doing chess very well, but he wants to get away from that and say he wouldn't really be thinking of it as intelligence unless it could actually seriously engage on a human level. As I put it, I think somewhere I write, of course, there is a subtext to his writing, which is that he's writing on the face of it about what machines can do, but he's also saying, I'm human. I know what being human is all about. And he was like that. And he spoke as he wrote. And so you get a picture of what he was like to talk to from that.
When you are making a film about a book or about the life of anyone, you have to take some license. You have to distill certain elements. And a lot of people are paying attention to the sort of the Keira Knightley role. This she plays in the film, the role of Joan Clark, a woman with which he has a relationship. He asks her to marry him. Alan Turing does, Joan Clark. But one of the things that comes up is the question of whether, in fact, there was a little bit of license taken, maybe too much license with that relationship, that it didn't really reveal the truth of that story, or maybe put too much into that story. Do you want to say anything about that?
Well, I'll talk about what I see as the actual more wider situation. I mean, we've really got to think about the whole development of Alan Turing's life and self-consciousness and confidence as a gay man from the whole period from his early life until his death. And, of course, it changes. It changes with his own experience, and it changes with the historical social changes of that time as well. And the 1930s, he was certainly very clear about his desires, but he couldn't have been very confident about himself, his future and his whole life and identity as a gay man, because what model could you possibly have? I mean, I've compared him with Maynard Keynes, who was a good example, but Maynard Keynes was very definitely officially married. I mean, that's what many gay men did. Yeah. And Turing's one of his closest friends, Fred Clayton, was in a very similar position. He got married too, and that was what gay men did. You found on the whole, the encouragement was to find a relationship that could work in some way, and that would satisfy everyone, hopefully. I mean, that was typical. So I think Alan Turing sort of certainly thought he should have a go at that when he found himself very, very friendly with Joan Clark, who joined as a mathematician. She was a master's level mathematician who joined. Her supervisor was Gordon Welchman, who was Alan Turing's colleague, and she joined up quite early and joined in the code-breaking work. And they were buddies. I mean, they liked doing things together, but they weren't, as Joan put it in a television interview, there wasn't very much physical contact.
Right.
And also, he told her right away. I mean, there was a day after, and he rather surprised her by making an engagement marriage proposal. But then the very next morning, he said, well, actually, probably wouldn't work out because he had homosexual tendencies. And really, she knew, really, that yeah. wasn't going to happen. And the clinching thing, really, was when they went away to Wales for a walking holiday. It was a few months later. And I think it must be the case that the expectation of slightly greater intimacy by doing that just meant it was a no-go. And he did cut it off. When he cut it off, he said it was in a very serious way. And he actually quoted the words from Oscar Wilde's The Ballad of Reading Gaol, "For each man kills the thing he loves. By this bow will be known, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. The brave man does it with a sword." And it was a great, it must have been a big watershed thing. Mm. After that point, he certainly did develop much more positively his identity as a gay man. In 1944, he was very, very much more open and positive with this young engineer he was working with on the speech encipherment. And after the war, he developed his more exploratory gay side a lot more, and also had a boyfriend who he met at Cambridge, Neville Johnson, from 1948 until the disaster of 1951. So there's a whole development of his life. I mean, you have to see it in that context.
Right.
So with Joan, it was what many, many gay men would have done at that point, but he couldn't go through with a completely conventional cover-up type thing. That just wasn't for him at all. Yeah.
Well, a man who was so uninterested in BS, as you say. I mean, when he was arrested and finally came to trial, this was in, as you say, 1951, 1952, I suppose, he comes to trial. And he, as you point out, and he told people he didn't see anything wrong at all with his actions.
Yes, by that time he was very clear about that. And he went, yeah, that didn't do him any good, I may say. I mean,
right.
he gave a very clear statement to the police, which was probably a big mistake in individual terms. He should have just said nothing at all, probably. But he gave a very clear statement of what had happened. I mean, it's important that he went to the police because he saw what had happened as an implicit form of blackmail. So he stood up to that immediately to his own disadvantage. That's what precipitated it. And the police are much more interested in him than the blackmail succeeded in a way. I don't know quite what right word is here, but anyway, it had its effect, and so his crime was taken very seriously. In fact, well, he and the lad he'd picked up, well, they were both on trial for the same crime actually, Alan was treated much more seriously.
Yeah.
But he didn't show any remorse or repentance or whatever. And his reaction, as I mentioned, is this sideways move thing. He just said, well, I can go abroad then. And he insisted on that.
What do you make of, there's a lot of questions I've seen in the press lately about whether or not, in fact, Alan Turing had committed suicide. I mean, he was found by his cleaner. When she came in, this was June of 1954, died of cyanide poisoning. There was this half-eaten apple beside his bed, and his mother, of course, said no, he had accidentally ingested it. That others say that he had committed suicide, and there's question now about what had happened. Where are you these days on that question?
Oh, exactly the same as in the book. I mean, he I'm sure it was suicide, and he had devised a plan for doing it, which precisely could allow his mother to believe it was an accident. I mean, she'd always nagged him about chemistry experiments and, you know, it's so dangerous and wash your hands and all this kind of thing. How else could you take a deadly poison and pretend it was an accident by you dressed it up as a chemistry experiment? Cyanide is used for gold plating, and he did a bit of that, and she fell for it. And anyway, I mean, it worked very well. Other people may believe it as well, but I certainly don't. I mean, his stomach was full of cyanide. It wasn't just an accidental. Yeah. It's not really possible. But the other thing is that the significance of the apple. I mean, it had this practical role, and I think that was the original form of the plan that he devised, actually back in 1937, when he was away at Princeton, and I think feeling very miserable, probably then miserable about his gay identity. But also, of course, everyone knows that this is an extraordinary story, that... it, of course, is just like the apple in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And he went to see this film in 1938 when it came out in England, and was noted for relishing the famous scene with the sleeping death. His running partner in 1951, we haven't mentioned this, but he was a champion,
of course,
amateur athlete, and went in for very long distance runs, quite a lot. And we had a running partner who was this 18-year-old lad who was at school in Manchester, who they just met by being like joggers out in the evening, and they ran together. As this typically weird Alan Turing story. So they chatted about this and that, and at one point the Walt Disney film came up. And oddly enough, they both saw this as an absolutely iconic moment. And Alan, well, they're both called Alan, so this is rather confusing, but Alan Turing went on about the significance of the green and the red and death and life and whatever, and this made a great impression on the on the other guy. And I really no doubt at all that he'd formulated this plan as a practical plan, but rather liked it because it had this extra symbolic significance as, well, it's the Garden of Eden. It's the, it's leaving the innocent world of mathematics for the world of actually doing something, which in a practical way, which he'd had done and was inescapably mixed up in. I mean, to my mind, the most salient thing about his situation before his death was, of course, his security status. He wasn't just any gay man who'd been kept, been caught up in this crackdown against gays in the early 1950s. He was the top guy in the most secret Anglo-American stuff of the lot. I mean, it was just as sensitive as anything to do with the nuclear warfare. And he knew a hell of a lot, and all the people, all the methods and everything about what was going on. And, of course, he was a very unknown quantity. He was roaming around Europe, having vowed to not be stopped by the English law. And who would have known what he was getting up to, or who he might meet, or who he might be entrapped by? Of course, that was a big worry, and of course that was must have weighed on him, and his surveillance that he certainly experienced must have been a big, big problem in his life.
Mm. Let me ask you this finally. You write in the preface of your book that his simple openness about his sexuality came decades too early. I guess that's one of the tragedies of his story, I suppose.
Yes, I think that sums up what he was like. I mean, anyone of that period had to form some sort of balance between practicality and the ideal of honesty. And he was more in the direction of honesty than almost anyone else, I think, at that point. More and more, in fact, as he got older, he was just more and more clear. So that he was very open about what had happened with the arrest and the trial and this punishment with the hormone treatment. When he was just in ordinary water cooler talk in the Manchester Computing Laboratory, which was the most macho and it was by no means some great haven of progressive thought. I mean, he just talked about it for the sake of it. I mean, because he thought it was right that people should know the truth.
Andrew Hodges. He's a mathematician and writer. His book is Alan Turing, The Enigma. You can find a link to his website on Turing at radiowest.kuer.org. The biography inspired the film The Imitation Game, which is screening at the Broadway Center Cinemas and in theaters around the Valley. You can get more information about that on our website as well. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.